Chapter 47.
I suppose there was a wry humour in the fact that my call-out papers arrived on my birthday, but I didn't see the joke at the time. The event is preserved in my memory in a picture which is as clear to me today as when I walked into our dining room that morning. Helen perched away up on a high stool at the end of the table, very still, eyes downcast. By the side of my plate, my birthday present, a tin of Dobie's Blue Square tobacco, and next to it, a long envelope. I didn't have to ask what it contained. I had been expecting it for some time, but it still gave me a jolt to find that I had only a week before presenting myself at Lord's Cricket Ground, St. John's Wood, London. And that week went by at frightening speed as I made my final plans, tidying up the loose ends in the practice, getting my Ministry of Agriculture form sent off, arranging for our few possessions to be taken to Helen's old home, where she would stay while I was away. Having decided that I would finish work at tea time on Friday, I had a call from old Arnold Summergill at about 3 o'clock that afternoon. And I knew that that would be my last job, because it was always an expedition rather than a visit to his small holding, which clung to a bracken-strewn slope in the depths of the hills. I didn't speak directly to Arnold, but to Miss Thompson, the postmistress in Hainby Village.
"Mr. Summergill wants you to come and see his dog," she said over the phone.
"What's the trouble?" I asked. I heard a muttered consultation at the far end.
"He says its leg's gone funny."
"Funny? What do you mean, funny?" Again the quick babble of voices.
"He says it's kind of sticking out."
"All right," I said. "I'll be along very soon." It was no good asking for the dog to be brought in. Arnold had never owned a car, nor had he ever spoken on a telephone. All our conversations had been carried on through the medium of Miss Thompson. Arnold would mount his rusty bicycle, pedal to Hainby, and tell his troubles to the postmistress. And the symptoms. They were typically vague, and I didn't suppose there would be anything either funny or sticking out about the leg when I saw it. Anyway, I thought as I drove out of Danaby, I wouldn't mind having a last look at Benjamin. It was a fanciful name for a small farmer's dog, and I never really found out how he had acquired it. But after all, he was an unlikely breed for such a setting, a massive old English sheepdog, who would have looked more in place decorating the lawns of a stately home than following his master around Arnold's stony pastures. He was a classical example of the walking hearthrug, and it took a second look to decide which end of him was which. But when you did manage to locate his head, you found two of the most benevolent eyes imaginable, glinting through the thick fringe of hair. Benjamin was, in fact, too friendly at times, especially in winter, when he had been strolling in the farmyard mud, and showed his delight at my arrival by planting his huge feet on my chest. He did the same thing to my car, too, usually just after I had washed it, smearing clay lavishly over the windows and bodywork, while exchanging pleasantries with Sam inside. When Benjamin made a mess of anything, he did it right. But I had to interrupt my musings when I reached the last stage of my journey. And as I hung onto the kicking, jerking wheel, and listened to the creaking and groaning of springs and shock absorbers, the thought forced its way into my mind, as it always did around here, that it cost us money to come to Mr. Summergill's farm. There could be no profit from the visit, because this vicious track must knock at least £5 off the value of the car on every trip. Since Arnold did not have a car himself, he saw no reason why he should interfere with the primeval state of his road. It was simply a 6-foot strip of earth and rock, and it wound and twisted for an awful long way. The trouble was that to get to the farm you had to descend into a deep valley before climbing through a wood towards the house. I think going down was worse, because the vehicle hovered agonizingly on the top of each ridge before plunging into the yawning ruts beyond, and each time, listening to the unyielding stone grating on sumpen exhaust, I tried to stop myself working out the damage in pounds, shillings and pence. And when at last, mouth gaping, eyes popping, tires sending the sharp pebbles flying, I ground my way upwards in bottom gear over the last few yards leading to the house, I was surprised to see Arnold waiting for me there alone. It was unusual to see him without Benjamin. He must have read my questioning look, because he jerked his thumb over his shoulder. "He's in Taos," he grunted, and his eyes were anxious.
I got out of the car and looked at him for a moment as he stood there in a typical attitude, wide shoulders back, head high. I have called him old, and indeed he was over 70, but the features beneath the woolen tammy, which he always wore pulled down over his ears, were clean and regular, and the tall figure lean and straight. He was a fine-looking man, and must have been handsome in his youth, yet he had never married. I often felt there was a story there, but he seemed content to live there alone, a bit of an ermit, as they said in the village. Alone, that is, except for Benjamin.